Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Miss Baby, and I am your host, Liv, here with a conversation episode, surprise, surprise, but this one is directly connected with this past Tuesday's episode, all about Helen of Sparta. I spoke with Alexia Burrows Carol Ambidu all about the concept of the Kalon Kakon, the beautiful evil that is so often used to refer to, I mean, very specifically Pandora, but Alexia's got some incredible points about women beyond Pandora that can be termed this so-called beautiful evil in ancient Greek. There's sort of a set of opposites, the Kalon, Kakon, and it's utterly fascinating. I've wanted to look more into this for ages, and so Alexia reached out and said, hey, I've just been studying this. And I was like, this is perfect, incredible. So we had such a fun conversation. We did talk for a really long time about a host of different things. So, you know, there are moments where it might be clear that you missed a conversation, switch in there. But honestly, it was so much fun. I learned so much. Alexia is so knowledgeable on this. Completely fascinating. We really had so much fun. It was so lovely having Alexia on, and I hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation episode in large part about, oh, that fascinating woman I have spent 2 weeks talking about already, Helen of Sparta. Conversations, Helen as the Beautiful Evil, the Kalon Kakon, with Alexia Burroughs Karalambidou. So, Kalon Kakon. It's so fun. I'm so fascinated with this whole topic because it's something I'm just slowly starting to learn ancient Greek. I've sort of stopped for a while.
But I understand that.
Yeah, it's tough. I got deep into modern Greek before I went, which I think is a lot more practical.
That's really useful, yeah.
Exactly. And I really like it. Yeah, so I mean, I just think this whole concept is so interesting. And then I was reading Pandora's Jar by Natalie Haynes. And yes, so good generally, but she gives such a really an interesting, I mean, she gives the sort of take on it. I'm going to dive too far in and we're not even going into the episode yet. But Kalon Kakon, for my listeners, has a lot of different translations possible. Beautiful evil is how it's most commonly translated. But as I learned with Natalie Haynes, it can also be beautiful ugly, which is a really fascinating difference. And so, yeah, I mean, you're the one here to talk about that, so I won't go too far into it.
So it's such an interesting topic. I think it's something that people they'll read Hesiod and they'll come across Kalon Kakon or Beautiful Evil as it's usually translated. Obviously, Natalie Haynes has shone an entirely different light on it, which is so cool. But it's something that people will read in Hesiod and they'll just be like, oh, okay, cool. Okay, she's beautiful and evil. That's great. Because a lot of people going into Hesiod, at least now, already know the myth of Pandora. She has the box, pithoi, of course.
Not at all a box. Yeah, an enormous jar.
It's a nice jar. It's a lovely Greek jar. And they'll go, oh yeah, she's going to release all the evils. That's great. And leave the other one in the jar. Usually depicted as a butterfly, you know. That's what modern things kind of draw it as, which I find really weird. But
hope is a butterfly. All right.
I enjoy that. It's cute, but I don't really get it. But, you know.
No, I agree. It's pretty, I'm sure, but I don't really see the reference point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think people just go across it and they go, oh, okay, cool, and just move on and forget entirely about it. But I saw it and I thought, oh, that's a really interesting concept. So I decided to go into it a bit and I discovered a whole plethora of scholarship and just interesting takes on it. Obviously, most of them focus on Pandora, but then I saw it in another book, Ruby Blondell's book on Helen, or it was Bethany Hughes's book on Helen. Someone had said that Helen of Troy was also a Kalon Kakon, and I went, okay, I've read about that before. I went, that's a really interesting take, and I love Helen of Troy. I am a Helen of Troy enthusiast. I love her. I think she's brilliant. People disagree.
I think she's fascinating. I definitely want to do more study on her. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely should, because she's so cool.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't think this is an angle, because it's very briefly mentioned, I would argue. I haven't seen a dedicated paper on it before. So I was like, I want to do that. I'm going to do that. And I read into it and I saw lots of arguments for why. And you have to define what Kalon Kakon is, especially I obviously took the route of beautiful evil because I think that one seemed the most enticing to me. And at the time I hadn't actually read Pandora's Jar. I read that about halfway through writing it, and I was like, oh no, another angle.
Yeah.
So I looked into it and I was just astounded at the gap almost that had been left, so I just endeavored to look into it even more. But I found that you can apply it to a good few things. You've got Pandora, obviously, who was the blueprint, really. And then you've got Helen, who was the natural follow-up for Pandora, really, because very beautiful and yet caused so much strife and harm and evil, as it was. But then you've got women like Medea. And also you've got Circe to an extent, or Turkey, depending on your pronunciation. I found that you could apply it to metals also, mainly necklaces, and specifically the metal of gold, because that's seen as Aphrodite's metal, which I found really interesting. I'm not sure where that exactly originated from, but one of the ones I found really interesting was in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, and it describes her as she was being dressed by the
Horai.
I
think it's Horai. It's the seasons. They're like they're dressing her so that she can go meet up with Anchises because Zeus and good stuff.
Of course, thanks Zeus. So the seasons are dressing her, and she's just dripping with gold. She's got gold on her head. She's got gold earrings, and she's got gold. The sentence that really jumped out to me was that they'd put it right on her breasts. So they'd gone.
They're like painting her almost?
Yeah, like that. So they're like, on her immortal head, they put a finely wrought diadem, a beautiful gold one, and in her pierced earlobes, flowers of oricale, I'm assuming that means orchids, and precious gold. About her tender throat and white breasts, they decked her in golden necklaces. And I just love that. She is dripping in gold. They've gone, right, I'm going to put it right on her chest and on her tender neck. And it just, it's very seductive. And I think that was absolutely the intention. Obviously, she's going for a meetup. Cheeky meetup.
With the mortal.
Yes, with the mortal. How shameful. Of course, for a woman, of course, not for the men.
No.
Not for Zeus. And that is all just, so it's such beautiful imagery, but also it's very erotic, I would say. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of repeated also. There's another story concerning Aphrodite and gold. So necklaces are apparently frequent tokens of erotic treachery, which I didn't know before embarking on this. I read it and I was like, oh, that sounds great. and I had a look into it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's actually a really good point. So Aphrodite had given to Helen this necklace, which was very gorgeous, of course. It was a gift from the goddess of love to the most beautiful woman in the world. So after Helen went to Troy, she didn't take it with her. Menelaus decided to dedicate it to a temple. And it ended up in the hands of this beautiful but lustful young woman who echoed Helen's behaviour. So she ended up falling in love with a man, a young man. They were both unmarried and they ran away together. And there's a bit of discourse on whether that was like because of the necklace or because of her generally, and she was attracted to the necklace because of this. But I found it so interesting that gold especially was used in that story, and it's very cool.
Okay, now I have to ask. Okay,
because
you're sort of blowing my whole mind on a lot of like on this topic, but specifically as it relates to, so I'm so curious if any of this has come up in relation to the necklace of Harmonia.
I personally haven't looked into it, but I expect it would have.
Yeah,
because that's like
a somewhat cursed necklace, depending on what you read and from when or whatever. But it's, and she's the daughter of Aphrodite, and it's given to her from Hephaestus. And oh my gosh, I've got so many questions now. Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. That's a whole little research project.
I mean, there's a certain novel that's been in the works for like 10 years about Cadmus and Harmonia and that necklace. So now you just helped me out a little bit.
I saw you writing it down and I was like, oh, she's found something she likes.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Necklaces and gold especially is a massive thing, I think, for Kalon Kakon. And people might be wondering why. So you've got the obvious Kalon side, the beautiful side, going, oh yes, they're very beautiful, very seductive, very nice. But obviously in a lot of these stories with the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, obviously she doesn't want Anchises to know that she is the immortal goddess Aphrodite. There is an element of deception in that. And she's like disguising herself as this young maiden, and it's all like a big secret. So there's deception baked right into that, which is much what Pandora is like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the same with Helen's necklace. Like, no one knows it has these powers almost lurking underneath the surface, if you will. Not necessarily that there are powers within the necklace, but that they're kind of echoing Helen's behavior, or Aphrodite's lustful powers are being kind of channeled through this.
Yeah.
So Pandora herself, when she's being created, obviously she's molded out of clay or earth, depending on which translation you get.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's dressed by goddesses and graces and everything beautiful like that. Molded by Hephaestus and then dressed by Athena in some of them. So Pandora is kind of enhanced. Athena gifts her in Works and Days a girdle and ornaments, and the Graces give her golden jewellery. Once again, that gold is coming back up. And then the Seasons are dressing her in spring flowers and kind of doing with perfume. I haven't looked into perfume, but it is another angle that you could look at. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have the room, unfortunately.
Yeah, so many things.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my gosh, everything interlinks as well. So it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. I love this topic.
From Theogony, which is the one where the Kalonkakon is actually referenced. It's not referenced in Hesiod's Works and Days. I'm not sure why, but he seems to have omitted that phrase.
And just to remind my listeners, I think too, like I'm going to admit, like, might link the Pandora episode in this as well, because I recently covered Pandora and she's so interesting because Hesiod covers her in both Theogony and Works and Days in like fairly different ways. So it's interesting.
It's so weird because I was looking at it and I was like, these are different people.
So yeah, to note that it's only in the Theogony, I think is interesting, because also he's shittier to women in Works and Days than the Theogony.
Hesiod is just shitty to women.
For sure. That's why I say shittier.
One of my lecturers in my first year said something rather profound about Hesiod. She went, Hesiod is as bright and intelligent as he was to be able to write and publish and everything like that, was quite a simple man, and he would be absolutely astounded that his works were being studied thousands of years in the future, but he would be absolutely horrified that there were women in the class.
Oh!
And it really made me laugh, and I was like, you know what, you are absolutely right.
Oh my god, absolutely, that guy.
So in Theogony, Pandora is adorned in silvery clothing rather than gold. She has a highly wrought veil. It doesn't give her an indication as to colour. Flower garlands, once again, and a golden headband. The golden headband is what I really like to focus on, because it's got all of these gorgeous engravings. Hephaestus made it, once again. But it's the description of this diadem. It's highly wrought. It's endowed with terrible monsters, but also these beautiful creatures, and gracefulness is breathed right in, which I believe is the quote. And they're all also endowed with speech, which I found really interesting, because I'm not sure how you endow a headband with speech, but if you can make clay into a woman, you know, I'm not going to question it. And I really took that as a reflection of Pandora herself. So she's this, that this headband is something that's been molded and wrought by Hephaestus, and it's been created by him, such as Pandora has been. And then the breath and the speech and everything has, and her gracefulness has been breathed in, and it's all been gifts from the gods. So Pandora's name actually translates to all gifts, according to some people. I don't study ancient Greek language, so I can't check that myself, but this is what I've read.
Yeah.
And this is what they say. I really enjoyed the duplicity in the diadem and Pandora herself, because I just found it so interesting that they kind of did the same things. So you've got this terrible monster that's kind of smoothed over with the gracefulness, much like Pandora, which really echoes Hesiod's sentiment as Pandora being a Kalonkakon.
Yeah. Well, and what I find so interesting about it, and this is, you know, my main sort of reference point for Kalonkakon was having read it in Pandora's Jar, so I'll preface with that. But I find it so interesting, the idea that it can mean ugly as well, because, you know, what Natalie Haynes then sort of clarified with that is that they're two equally descriptive words about more visual descriptive versus, you know, like Pandora being beautiful ugly is so different from her being beautiful evil. You know, evil is like she thinks about it, she does this on purpose, she, you know, releases those evils on purpose. And of course, you know, I think Hesiod would probably want it translated as beautiful evil, right?
Yeah, I don't think he would mind.
I don't think so. But at the same time, if you actually like are looking at her story, like she doesn't have any agency in it. She doesn't like think, like all the modern interpretations of Pandora suggest that, or like, you know, I should say pop culture, you know, like not academic, but you know, the modern understanding of her is like, oh yeah, she was this curious woman. Like she was the Eve. She sought to look in and free the evils. Like she did it because of her own feminine curiosity, right? Whereas if you read the sourcing, like, no. Like it she
also,
doesn't.
Also, if I am
yes, please.
Hermes was the one who instilled this, I think they call it a bitch's mind and knavish nature.
Yes.
And like that was a man. Like while Aphrodite did instill curiosity, curiosity isn't inherently a bad thing. It was Hermes that instilled what they would consider to be the negative traits.
Yeah, the trickster god did this. You know, like it's so interesting. And really, like she doesn't choose to open it. She doesn't say like I'm gonna fuck shit up or I'm gonna ignore instructions. All these things. She just opens it.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, it opens, like whether or not she even does it. She's just there. And absolutely, it was a gift to her. So she gets the blame in this really fascinating way of, I think looking at it as beautiful, ugly is like, it's just amazing. Cause you're like, right. It's just like, it's imagery placed upon her versus something that she does. But I mean, even just like looking at it as beautiful, evil is still just equally fascinating, especially when you look at Hesiod, because he really like, he lets it all really hang out when it comes to the two stories of Pandora, but like how he sees women.
I think that's Hesiod for you.
Oh my God.
There's there's another bit of it that I always find really interesting. So she's described as a precipitous trap. As well, she is this is what her destiny is. She is there to wreak havoc because Prometheus stole the fire, and Zeus wasn't too pleased about it, because when Zeus doesn't get his own way, bad shit happens.
Absolutely.
He's like a spoiled toddler. I don't really...
We all know how I feel about Zeus.
So like her whole thing was she was meant to be a curse. That's what she's described as. The first curse is Pandora. And the second curse in Hesiod is the avoidance of marriage and children. So men who don't marry these horrific women that Zeus and the gods have created have inflicted their own curse upon themselves by not doing that. So you're cursed either way because of woman, according to Hesiod. But we have to remember whose actions led to this. It's Prometheus. Like, we can't blame it all on Pandora. She was just molded. It wasn't her fault.
And it's also just like the idea of Zeus being a vindictive asshole, right? Like, you know, yes, as much as it is because of what Prometheus did. Like, if Zeus wasn't such a shit who needed to have his way all the time, wouldn't have caused any trouble either.
Absolutely. But I love that she is the blueprint for women also. Mm-hmm. So she's the one that everything is based upon. It's not necessarily based upon the gods. She is in the image of the gods, so we know that she is absolutely bloody gorgeous, because by definition, apart from the Furies, of course, all goddesses are gorgeous. As far as it goes. So we know she's gorgeous, but on the inside it's this rotten interior. And this idea carries on and on and on and on. And this idea of molding your wife, of course, also continues in Ischomachus's, not Ischomachus's, but he is the man speaking, in Oikonomachus, I believe it's by Xenophon. He talks about how Ischomachus molds his wife. He's having a conversation with Socrates.
Of course.
And Socrates is talking to Ischomachus, and and Ischomachus is telling him how he molded his very, very young wife. Like, he wanted her to know as little as possible, which creeps me out in ways I can't imagine. Like, I can't even describe how much I hate it. But, like, he's like, I wanted her to know as little as possible. And then one day she came. She came to me when I come home from, I think he was working in the fields. One day I came home and she was wearing, she'd rouged her cheeks and she'd whitened her face. And she'd altered her height by wearing shoes with blocks in them. And he was like, what is this deception? Do you think that as husband and wife, we should deceive each other? This is terrible, terrible, awful. I prefer you as plain as possible, essentially. Is what he's saying. He's like, no, I don't like you in makeup. Other men will find you hot. Like, I don't like that. No.
The way you can see that mentality in some modern...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, oof. Yeah. Oh, so many feelings there.
So many feelings. But, like, this idea that this exterior of beauty, because obviously this young wife was trying to beautify herself, and she says, oh, but, you know, I did this for you. And he's like, I don't care. In more words, of course, he's trying to be very charming about it, because ancient Greek men like to big themselves up, I think, especially in a Socratic conversation.
Yeah.
Xenophon, it's got to be pretty, of course. So she's like, oh, I did this for you. And he's like, oh, I don't want you to, because the more beautiful you are, the more attention you'll attract, and then the more havoc will be brought, which is exactly kind of what happens with Pandora. She's beautiful and attracts a lot of attention from Epimetheus, bless him, the god of afterthought. I feel very bad for that man. Like, oh. He's the only innocent one, I've decided.
I can see that, yeah. I mean, he really had no control over it. Like, he is literally the god of afterthought.
So you get that with Pandora, where, like, she's beautiful but concealing something, much like this wife is considered to be by Ascomachus. But then you have Helen, who is so beautiful, she causes, at the time, in quotation marks, of course, the biggest war that the world had ever seen. Like, it puts out this idea that being pretty or beautiful or considered, like, above average is a lot of trouble. So in ancient Greece, in more kind of a classical period, when the citizenship law by Pericles came about, a lot of women were meant to stay inside away from men, because if they went outside, it would cause trouble because they're beautiful. And you see this in Lysias 1, where this wife goes to a funeral, and this man sees her. This wife is young, she's married, she's had a baby with her husband, and Lysias makes that very, very clear that they've already had the baby because of the citizenship, how the citizenship law works, because otherwise the child would be considered illegitimate and would not be able to inherit property once the father died. And he's like, she went to a funeral, she was in mourning, and yet still a man was attracted to her and caused trouble. So it reinforces that women should be locked away kind of message, which is just so, one, wrong. Like, it's wrong, for one. But it's, like,
very classically Athenian.
Yeah, it's very Athenian. But it's so interesting in how all of this just interlinks.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, yeah, because, you know, they cause so much trouble if they're just out and about being good looking. Ugh.
How dare they?
Right? The nerve. The nerve. Yeah, that's, I mean, so I, because I've sort of now developed this love of this idea of the beautiful, evil, beautiful, ugly, I named a cocktail in my new cocktails book, and I'll reveal it now in this episode.
I feel so blessed and to be gifted this knowledge.
And I did something weird with it, you know? So I'm like, the more I listen, I'm kind of like, I'm curious about what I did and how it'll be. I mean, it's a cocktail, it doesn't matter. But so I chose to go with beautiful, ugly for Medusa.
Ooh.
Yes, because I thought it was just an interesting way of addressing, you know, obviously I am me and this is my world. So if I'm going to have a Medusa cocktail, like, it's going to address the fact that, like, she is deeply misunderstood and pop culture representation is completely wrong and all these different things. So I use Beautiful Ugly to kind of go with that and suggest that, you know, she, like, her monstrosity is questionable, I would argue. It's very, like, I think it's pretty unclear. Like, we have, you know, we have a lot of Gorgon imagery that often it's not named Medusa until, yeah, unless it, when it just looks like a Gorgon. And I find that so fascinating. She's the only mortal one, you know, there's so many things, but I decided that it sort of suited her when it comes to taking her story back from Perseus of, like, she is a beautiful ugly. She is kind of, she's just sort of all things, but none of them required her to be killed by Perseus. That was, you know,
that
purely
was a dick move, man.
Exactly. It was 100% just because, like, Polydectes wanted Perseus killed and he was going to do it by having him, you know, die trying to kill Medusa. Yeah. But, like, it's just, I will take it upon myself to constantly push back against the idea that she was deserving of death in any way. And I just, yeah, I don't know. I suppose using Beautiful Evil was an interesting way to do that. But then, because of the layout of my book, I think I'm pretty sure the very next cocktail, it's like a section later, but is Pandora's Jar. So then I go even deeper into the Beautiful Evil or Beautiful Ugly.
Exciting.
Yeah, so it's very fun. So yeah, there's a lot of, honestly, for a book of cocktails, this is, like, the most academic shit. Like, I'm like, I'm gonna,
you
teach
know
people
that
ancient Greek, and, like, oh yeah, the level of nerd that is in this, like, you know, two paragraphs for each cocktail.
You know what?
Pretty,
it's like a reward system. Read something academic, get drunk. I think, exactly. I see it as a win-win.
Absolutely. And I just bought the ingredients to make the Beautiful Ugly, the Medusa cocktail. So I'm gonna have to make one soon. And the garnish for it is a rose with the thorns on.
I love that with my
no, I don't
heart.
Know how you can do it with a cocktail. Like,
I don't know how you're
gonna
drink that without
no.
injuring yourself.
Well, you're supposed
I believe
to drape
you.
It you're supposed to drape it on the glass, I think. It seems a little complicated to me, but interesting.
I do love that.
And
though.
Beautiful ugly, I guess.
I love that. I love that with my whole heart.
Helen, so I'd love to know more about
Helen
generally and how Helen fits in with all of this. Not that you haven't said a lot already, but I just want to talk about Helen, basically.
Helen is my one true love. I adore
her. As she should be.
There's that key line about her that appears absolutely everywhere. The face that launched 1,000 ships. And, I mean, it didn't. There was not 1,000 ships, if there were any ships, actually. But I like the line. It's a good line. It's
if
really,
not classical.
It's glorifying her beauty to such an extent, which I've kind of assumed has probably come from her Olympian paternity rather than her mortal paternity, because her siblings, I can't remember which way around it is, one of the twin boys is from the Olympian.
I think it's Castor.
Yeah,
but
I feel like it is.
Always,
but
yeah,
seen.
I always question it too.
Yeah,
yeah,
I'm always like,
with
wait.
You. It's one of them.
But not the other two are not described in such a way that Helen is. Helen is this vision of perfection. She is described in some cases as like a surrogate Aphrodite, which I can't be sure that Aphrodite would have enjoyed considering everything with Psyche.
Yeah, she doesn't really allow that.
Yeah, but she seems to give Helen a lot of gifts, so I think she's fine, to be fair. I think she's like, yeah, if I just pair you with my favorite guy Paris, it'll be fine. Yeah. She's like,
I almost wonder though whether that was part of it, right? Like, yeah, whether
maybe,
you know,
that's
the,
why she likes her so much.
Well, yeah, or like the subtle inclusion is that, like, you know, the little hidden pieces that Aphrodite knows it'll start a war, because, yeah, and then that's kind of her way of, you know, making Helen not so perfect.
Yeah.
Because if Helen started a war, then her beauty doesn't mean as much.
There has to be some flaws, you know, can't have it all nice and rosy.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll just start the biggest war the Mediterranean had ever seen.
Woo! Party time. So it's probably from her Olympian paternity, but we can assume that it has actually been enhanced by Aphrodite. mm-hmm. as in Iliad book 3, I believe, when she's calling Helen to come back inside and meet her lover Paris, she threatens to take away her gifts and her favor. So, and we do see the gods and goddesses beautifying or changing their appearance of the favourites. So I believe we see it in Apollonius and Argonautica with Jason, where Hera's mm-hmm. like, let's make him look spectacular. Like, shooting all these superpowers into him. So poor Medea.
Well, and Athena does it to Odysseus too, right?
Yeah,
you know, in
does.
Lots of different ways, disguising him, but then also when she finally
reveals
like
him.
Yeah, then she makes him look like as good as he's ever looked before, like, you know, he's yeah,
a handsome hunk of a man.
he goes from, you know, hidden Odysseus and an old man to like the hottest Odysseus you've ever seen.
Absolutely. So I think you see that beautification via the gods' interference, if you will, mm-hmm. and it's not just from her Olympian paternity, but this beauty is really, really hard to capture. I believe Cicero notes Zeuxis. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right. He's a painter, and he was commissioned to paint Helen of Troy. This was many, many years after she would have passed. Not necessarily suggesting that she was ever alive, but
right.
you know, it was many years after the Iliad was written, at least.
Yeah.
So he auditions all of the women in the city to find Helen's likeness, but none, unfortunately, possess the beauty of Helen.
No one can.
Yeah. So instead, he picks five girls who are the most beautiful, or five women. It's a bit I'm unclear on the exact translation. He selects the five most beautiful women and uses their best features. So he's like, oh, I'll take your face and then your arms and then your chest and then your bottom and then your legs. And he goes, that is how I will create Helen and her composite. But it's really interesting because her beauty, despite that we know that she is the most beautiful woman in the world, we don't know what she looks like.
No, we don't know what made her that beautiful. It's just like an inherent, like, indescribable thing.
They always describe her as like the most beautiful, or stunningly like the immortal goddess, or frighteningly like the immortal goddess, I believe is the quote from Iliad 3. But they never actually say why. They don't say her hair is as radiant as the sun or anything. They don't say anything like that, which is, you get a lot of epithets with other women. Mm-hmm. We occasionally get like white armed, or, you know, stuff like that. But that's very, very basic.
It's very traditionally just like that's how they describe women.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not really diverging from anything. But in this way, you also see Helen as quite similar to Pandora, because she is almost molded. And from the painting, we don't know what she looks like, much like Pandora. We don't actually know what she looks like. We're just told that she is moulded in the form of the immortal goddesses, much like Helen. She's frighteningly like the immortal goddess, referring to Aphrodite. So we can assume that they're fairly similar looking, actually. Neither are described. Their actual features are not described.
Mm-hmm.
And they are almost composite in this painting. So Helen is comprised of five different women. And Pandora is molded to resemble these goddesses.
Yeah.
They are very similar in this way. So you get the Calonne part, the beautiful part of Calonne Cacon, and you see it kind of coming to life. But then the interior, the lustfulness of Helen, or the curiosity or bitch's mind or knavish nature of Pandora comes through and gives you this evil that... Mm-hmm. is so toxic and poisonous to the people around them that it destroys, it absolutely engulfs everything. Like Pandora releases all of these evils into the world, and then Helen brings on the biggest war that the world has seen, or at least the Mediterranean. In
the
their world,
ships.
That is the world.
Well, exactly.
You know? So it's almost natural that they would both be considered Calonne Cacon. So it's really interesting on how similar they are, especially in their physicality.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I mean, they are just both the two most infamous women of Greek myth.
Absolutely.
By far. Yeah, and so I mean, it makes so much sense that their, you know, infamy would be linked to their looks, because that is just, you know, entirely the way women were
Absolutely.
Viewed. Yeah, like you can't be ugly and evil. Like, it just seems, you know, if you're ugly and evil, you're a monster. You're nothing in
between. Yeah, you're
nothing
a monster, you're a witch, you're a crone. I think that's a relatively normal comparison, even for the modern kind of interpretations of witches.
Mm-hmm.
But the ancient interpretations can be very, very different, especially with the kind of Kalon Kakon idea.
Yeah, because it's almost like, it, you know, it makes them sneakier.
Mm,
right,
absolutely.
It's like
that is that's the main thing, the deception.
Their evil is so much worse than a monster because you don't see it coming.
Yeah, at you're least if you're monstrous on the outside, you can expect it, but if you're
exactly
if you're beautiful on the outside, you're like, oh, it's kind of like Jason.
Yeah, that's so true.
One thing I always wanted to kind of compare to was Paris as well, because he's beautiful, but he also bought this absolute havoc upon poor Troy.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he would never be described as a Kalon Kakon, right? Like, he would never, because it didn't matter with men, right? Yeah. Like, it just, it's so interesting.
Everyone's
the way
busy describing him as a coward instead, because he uses a bow or he goes from the top or the back or whatever. They're not seeing him in the same way that they would see women, even though he is very feminized, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, like Helen gets to be the one, like, she, you know, she's the one to blame. She has agency in her blame, in their understanding, whereas he's just, he's just beholden to his cowardice. He's just, you know, he can't help it. He's just such a little worm. Like, yeah, it's, you know, I mean, it's just, it's so similar with Jason too, right? Like, Jason doesn't get the blame. He's just, it just happened. Things happen
Jason.
To him. He doesn't do anything. And like, yeah, that's
Jason is my least favorite. I
see, and I will die on the hill of Theseus, but Jason is awful.
Oh yeah, Theseus is awful as well, but Jason is awful.
Hey girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I'm a big Medea lover.
As you should be.
Yes, I think she's awesome. I will be going on to Cersei, actually. She's one of my favourite women when I get to my witchcraft section.
Ooh. Okay, wait, so there's witchcraft?
Yes, we have some witchcraft in here.
Okay, then please. Oh my god, keep going.
So, firstly, I'm going to continue on from Helen, because while people don't necessarily see her as a witch, she almost is in her own right. So you've got, obviously, in the Odyssey, you've got Helen using that pharmaca to dull all of the evils that might come up and make them basically not cry. It's I believe it's Nepenthe. It's like an anti-sorrow drug originating from Egypt. I think modern people have said, oh, I think it's opium. That's what a lot of modern scholars have gone, yeah, because that'll make you pretty, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll make you quite happy.
Chill. Yeah.
Chilled out, quite happy. Not really sad, you know, you're fine. So it erases these evils from the consumers. And there's a theory that she's always using this, even when Telemachus isn't there, to make this facade of the happy marriage between them and stop Menelaus from being so sorrowful. Because as you see, when he walks in and greets Telemachus, they're crying over the war, everyone's crying, it's all very sad. He's like, oh, my brother's dead, and Clytemnestra's dead, and all my friends are dead, and Odysseus is missing, and it's all very, very sad. So that was one time where Helen hasn't entered yet. She had entered, but she had not been able to administer the drugs as of yet. She administers them almost immediately after, before Menelaus is telling his stories. So there's this idea that, so Nepenthe is a form of pharmaca. So like a drug is the translation for it. It's actually literally translates as something you smear, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
So it can also be used for makeup, which is another route I dove down. And so it translates as something to smear, but it's also mainly used as describing drugs. So I believe Cersei, I believe it is Cersei, is described as a pharmakeus, a master of drugs, or a mistress of drugs. And Medea gets the same treatment. And I love that for her.
Yeah. Damn right.
Yeah. So obviously Helen is now employing these drugs, which is probably someone that no one really associates with this witchcraft and drug administering. Now, a lot of people may say, well, drug administering is not witchcraft, but then it was considered it, much like home remedies back in like the 16th century for like illnesses. So someone has an illness and a local herb woman like fixes them. They're like, she's a witch, we gotta burn her. Like back then it was considered like a marvel, something's really interesting. And
They were considered witches. Pharmaca is like, it's everything, but then of course it's where we get pharmacy from.
Yeah,
so
it meant
so much. But of course, yeah, the idea of witchcraft is basically just like healing things half the time. Yeah.
It also is obviously, I'm going to use it for also some more negative, if you will.
Well, yeah. I mean, Medea does some bad stuff with her pharmaca.
Just a touch.
Respect.
Yeah, it's fine. But... it's fine. Yeah. We'll just gloss over that. It's fine.
It's fine. I love Medea. She can do whatever she wants.
Helen administers this Nepenthe and makes Menelaus and Telemachus very, very happy. And it's all fine. So that's the glimmer we have in the Odyssey. But there is a further glimmer. So when Menelaus and Helen are telling their stories to Telemachus, Helen tells this story about how she co-conspired with someone and was really on their side, and she was just being a double agent the whole time. But Menelaus tells a story of when the Trojan horse is outside the city and she walks around it, kind of gliding her hands very seductively over this horse. And she's mimicking the voices of the Greeks' wives, calling out to them in their voices in this mimesis. It's the word that's used to describe it. And it's this very subtle power of witchcraft, and it's quite terrifying. And obviously someone is about to call out, so they're stabbed, because like they would have given the whole operation away. But she's so successful and so good at this like copycat voice that it's considered quite witchcrafty. And
it sounds like it.
It's so cool. I love it. Imagine being able to do people like that well.
Yeah.
That like people are like, oh, it's my wife outside, it's fine. But this idea of these vocal cries is kind of carried on with Circe. So she's described as dread goddess of human voice. And a lot of people have linked that to the sirens also in Odyssey 12, who, as we know, are really awesome. I love the sirens. I think it's
the
so
sirens
cool.
are very cool. Yeah, absolutely.
And I would like to compare that to Helen, because you don't necessarily get that comparison very often, because she is so good at making these beauteous sounds to these men, because obviously they're missing their wives, they've been gone for 10 years, they love them, they miss them, they want to have them back, that it's making them want to go and call out to her, much like the sirens try to draw Odysseus to them for inevitable slaughter, which is what would have happened if the men inside had called out. So this mimesis kind of puts her in the same league as the sirens and Circe, who is luring in Odysseus's men with her sweet singing in the Odyssey.
Right.
So I found that really, really interesting. There's also the really interesting comparison of Helen to Care. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Care, but she's like the bloodthirsty equivalent of Thanatos.
How do I not know? What? How do you spell her name?
K-E-R.
Wow.
She's really like low-key. Like,
I know, but I've read everybody. That's amazing.
I only found out about her when I was reading, and I've been looking at Greek stories my entire life. My dad used to read them to me when I was going to bed. So Care, she's this like female progenitor of death, if you will. And a lot of the demise of men from the Trojan War links Helen to her, because obviously without Helen this would not have happened. Assuming we follow the mythical version of the story, the demise of men was associated with Helen, because she was the one who bore all this blood and toil and death and all of this. So she's linked to a death goddess. But then you have in Aeschylus, in the Agamemnon, the choral ode says this: "She swerved aside and brought about a bitter end to the marriage, having come to the family of Priam as an evil settler, an evil companion sent by Zeus, god of hospitality, a fury who made brides weep." So she's compared to the Furies here, who are obviously like a vengeance demon, essentially. And they will fuck with you until the thing is done, you know?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
This other comparison with another underworld goddess is so striking to me, because I don't know, I just love it. I love that she's compared with these things, and it's obviously relatively mystical, being divine and all that. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. I'm like thinking about her in relation to Persephone and like Helen and Paris versus Hades and Persephone, and I'm just kind of like, oh man, I feel like I could take this so many different ways. That's so interesting.
Well, interestingly, Helen actually ends up marrying Achilles in the afterlife rather than anyone else. I mean, she's married. How is she married? She was abducted by Theseus. She's had a rough do, I would like to point out. She's had a really rough do. So she was made from an egg. You know, she was abducted by Theseus. And then she married Menelaus because his brother won a contest. And then she was abducted, or went with obviously the jury's out on that one, with Paris. Mm-hmm. And then he died and she married his brother, Deiphobus. Then she went back to Menelaus. And then when they all died, she marries Achilles in the afterlife in some, like, it's basically like a weird fanfic, but ancient Greek.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's a bit strange. Helen is the most multifaceted, like, mythological woman, like, yeah. ever. I love her. There's just so much material on her. There's just so yeah. many, like, different things, and I just find it so fascinating. I probably said that a million yeah. times in this episode, but, like, she's so fascinating. The whole voice thing is really mm-hmm. interesting, and how she, like, links into, like, Circe is really cool as well. And mm-hmm. I would say also her, like, seductiveness and her divinity yeah. does as well. So Helen's obviously very, like, she's very beautiful, she's very suave, very graceful. Circe is very much the same, especially, I would argue, in the Argonautica. Mm-hmm. So I know you read this relatively
very
recently.
Yeah.
But I loved Apollonius Rhodius writes, signaling softly with her hand, she offered a treacherous invitation for them to follow her, referencing Jason and Medea. And, like, we see her, she's washing her hair in the ocean, she's purifying herself, like, the sunlight's hitting her, it's like a movie, it's beautiful. I was like, go Apollonius, that is beautiful, that is a beautiful, you've really set the scene.
The second two books, like, the first two, I swear, are just, like,
conjecture.
They're just, like, nonsense, they're just, like, going on and on and on. And the second two books are, like, beautiful, like that, and I'm like, whoa, this is, like, two different works entirely, I swear. But
absolutely.
Yeah,
I studied the Argonautica last year during my degree, and I found the second two books a lot more interesting. But yes, it's like she's, like, very seductive, she's, like, pulling them towards her, she's going round, she's, like, circling them and, like, looking at them. It's very interesting. And obviously the treacherous invitation is something I really, like, want to hone in on, because mm-hmm. it's really that Kalon Kekon moment. So she's very seductive, she's very beautiful, she's gorgeous, and she's extending her hand for you to come in. And obviously we, or the readers, already know what she tends to do. We already know that she turns these men into pigs. Not sure what she would do with Medea, but she's her niece, it's fine. But the men, like, it's like you're gambling with this. Obviously Jason doesn't know that, and Medea's just like, oh, you know, it's my aunt, we'll be fine. But, like, she's really playing into that Kalon Kekon trope of she's very beautiful, very seductive, and but she's very treacherous, and you should be worried, much like Helen.
Yeah, and everyone would know the story, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, you know, Argonautica was written hundreds of years after the Odyssey,
I believe.
Yeah, yeah, it's Hellenistic. So, you know, it's so long after the Odyssey that, like, everyone listening and mm-hmm. would know, you know, yeah, what's, absolutely. Like, what Circe can do and what she's done in the past.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously the actual events of the Argonautica would have taken place before the Odyssey, like, in mm-hmm. tradition. Because Nestor from the Iliad was supposed to be one of the Argonauts.
Was he really? I know Peleus was. I forgot that Nestor was. Because Peleus, like, Achilles' dad was one of them. So, for sure. So, yeah.
Obviously, like, you know, they're older than it's aged. So they don't know, obviously, from Odysseus what has happened. Because, it's, mm-hmm. you know, that's in the future.
No, but the listener, the reader
the
would.
The reader, like, we all know. We're yeah. like, oh no, what's going to happen? We're on the edge of yeah. our seats. Like, oh dear. Like, I don't remember this happening, but maybe I'm wrong. I was just there like, mm-hmm. oh no, oh crap, is something bad going to happen?
Yeah.
But I didn't really like Jason at that point, so I was like, I'm kind of excited to see what happens yeah. next.
Jason's an asshole.
Totally agreed. He is my least favourite Greek man.
Yeah.
So she's obviously, in the Odyssey as well, she's again, very seductive and divine. She's singing beautifully in her house, and the members of Odysseus's ship are, like, looking through, apart from, like, a couple, the one that stayed back at the ship, which, you know, good call, you know, I'll give you that.
Yep.
With everything else that's gone on, can't really blame you. And, you know, she's there, like, and she's like, oh yes, like, you know, I'll feed you, I'll so she gives it these men who have come into her home the most base animal desires that they could want. She's like, I provide them food, I provided them drink, and obviously there's a beautiful woman here as well. So she's provided them their most base animal desires. But then she flips it by turning them into actual animals. which is where the witchcraft obviously comes in. Mm-hmm. And this metamorphosis would be like particularly horrifying to readers because it's somewhat emphasized, even subtly, but I think more so probably in the Greek, because obviously Greek doesn't always translate perfectly across mm-hmm. to English. So it takes away their expression, their language, and their like choice, which is what especially like Greek philosophers really love about the human condition. However, it keeps their minds intact. So they're fully aware that they're trapped inside the bodies of pigs. So this is incredibly distressing, because it might be okay if you were trapped inside the body of a pig if you did not know what was going on, if you just became the pig, like you know nothing else. Mm-hmm. But because they're like fully aware of what's gone on, this is so horrifying to Greek men, and it makes Circe out to be this absolute like awful, like this is the worst thing that she could do besides killing them and probably not burying them, I'd assume.
Yeah.
So she really flips this seductive and very welcoming and giving them these base animal desires into turning them into these animals that are as low as the ground she walks on, which I really love. I love the like duplicity and like the symbolism in that. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that. And, you know, also as they're walking up, they see this like her little magical menagerie, if you will. And some of them are like really unsettling and obscure. I can't remember whether this is the Odyssey or in the Argonautica, but there's these clay animals as well. Ooh. That look like really weird, essentially, is how I've kind of dubbed them. Like they don't look right. So the animals, the normal animals are like really tame and everyone's like, hey, that's not right. That tiger is... he's really chilled out. Why is he not trying to eat me? That's a bit weird. But then the clay animals, they don't look like animals, but you can tell they are animals. They're like on all fours, but they've got like extra limbs or two heads and just really strange. And this again calls back to Pandora, I would argue, because this clay molding of these animals who are really unsettling and quite scary is again much like Pandora. Obviously, it's removing the beauty, but it's invoking that Pandora image of like being molded and having this really unsettling thing beneath this really beautiful woman. So these are obviously Circe's pets. They're her even familiars, if you will, that keep her company on the island, other than the, I think it's written that there are some like nymphs and women who are also there that help provide drinks and stuff like that. But these are her companions, you know, these very strange clay animals. And it really does call back to Pandora and the whole tradition of kind of the witchcraft and flipping this beautiful, very welcoming woman, like exhibiting Xenia, which is like the moral code of the Greeks, essentially. It's like good housekeeping.
The guest-host relationship.
Yeah, like if someone turns up at your door, you let them in. If someone turned up at my door that I didn't know, I'd be like, nah, fuck off. But...
And you don't feed them your children.
Yes,
that's
I
the
would
key.
Avoid that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't get you anywhere.
That's how
Tantalus
got into some trouble, among others.
Yeah, it's not so good. And it tends to impact your entire house. You know, he's from the house of Atreus. That's Agamemnon
I mean,
and Menelaus.
Started,
his, like, great-grandfather. Yeah. He's what started all the trouble.
He started the house of Atreus. Yeah.
I'm going to blame him, actually, for everything that happened. Fair. It's all his fault for trying to feed Zeus his kids.
It absolutely is his fault. It's true.
That's why the Trojan War started, because he did a dumb thing. That's my
I mean, there's only one cursed family in the Trojan War, and, you know, it's not Helen. Well, I guess it is technically Helen, but it shouldn't be.
But
it's
that's
Helen
only because she married in. They're not
exactly.
related.
Exactly. No.
They're a separate being. Like, it's their fault. It's the men. But so I just think all the callbacks and how all the myths are like intertwined, and you know, some people will say like, oh, we're just reading too much into it, but in Greek history and Greek mythology and just Greek storytelling, it's probably because they are all intertwined, they're probably brought down through the oral tradition, because that's how all of these stories were told. Moving on from Circe, the direct path to go down is probably the familial one. So Medea, who I'm sure your listeners will be very familiar with. So obviously in Euripides' Medea, she's not looking her best, shall we say. She's described by Aegeus as like sallow and like tired and everything like that, because, you know, she's basically grieving essentially the loss of her husband, even though her husband was a shithead. Like, she's still really sad because, you know, she's had two kids with this man. And
well, and she's kind of like grieving the loss of her life through Jason, right?
Absolutely.
Because, like, yeah, like the thing I always try to emphasize is it's not like he just leaves her and she's like, oh, I'm heartbroken. Like, he leaves her, and he leaves her in a foreign place, unmarried, and, like, just basically without Jason, she has nothing because of her status.
She's got, like, a terrible reputation anyway because, like, you know, she's killed people. Which, you know,
and she's foreign. She's a barbarian.
Yeah, she's a barbarian. And as we know, I know we're speaking from Athens and we're in Corinth, but the status of barbarians among, especially the Athenians, was horrific.
Well, exactly. Euripides is an Athenian writing it, and so you get the status of barbarians and women.
Yeah.
And so Medea's fucked.
Barbarian murderer women. It's not the best mix to be left in a foreign country with when you can't go back to your family because, let's be honest, she fucked that.
Just
a
little.
She can't exactly, as you say, she can't exactly go to Peleus's daughters and be like, hi, remember me? I'm the lady who murdered your dad.
Euripides, I find, what I like about him is he at least in those, that book and like Back Eye, which are my two favorites, he tends to like stay away a little bit from divine representation. Like, he's more interested in what, you know, the humans are doing, which I love.
Absolutely. You know, Medea's not looking her best, and, you know, Aegeus is like, why do you look so sallow and sad? Which is a great thing to say to a grieving woman. I'm 10 out of 10, Aegeus. Like, brilliant. Really smooth, if you will.
Well,
you're
an
unmarried man looking for a wife. Like, what is you doing? He needs some lessons. I mean, he got her anyway, but I think that was due to other factors. Mitigating circumstances. But yeah, so she's not looking great, and she's really very sad. So the Kalonkakon stuff almost doesn't apply in Euripides' Medea. Because she's not looking her best. We can still assess that she was, at some level, very beautiful. Beautiful enough for Aegeus to go, yeah, you know what, I'd marry you. Yeah, why not? I'd have kids with you. That's fine. So she's still, like, quite beautiful, but she's not, like, her best looking. So it would actually weaken the argument, the Kalonkakon applying to her in this point. But you could look at it from a different view. So you could look at it in the clothes that she sends to Glauce. You could say, because they were gifts, apparently, from her grandfather, the son. So they're obviously going to be very, very beautiful clothes. And obviously the young princess is very taken with them. She puts them on immediately. She's twirling around in the mirror looking at them. They're obviously gorgeous, but they're tainted with this hidden poison, much like Pandora and Helen and Circe, all very, very beautiful, but tainted with this, like, sour underneath, this hidden, like, terribleness that is going to inflict great harm. This destructive poison kind of makes Medea akin to the Kalonkakon herself, but through her actions more so than through herself. And what's more with Medea as well. So we've spoken about Euripides and all of that stuff, but what people tend to focus on less with the Kalonkakon aspect especially is the Argonautica. So we are aware that she is beautiful. Once again, she is still divine because of her parentage on her father's side. She is the granddaughter of the sun, so, you know, she probably shines like the sun in some way or something. That's often how a lot of people who are related to the sun are described, actually. And, you know, her beauty's commented on a lot, but one that really, really sticks out to me is her divinely sweet head. I really like that one because I was like, that is such a contrast to her later thing. That's like anti-foreshadowing. I love it.
Yeah, it's very... It sounds very not Medea.
Yeah, that's like, I think that's when we first meet her in book 3 of the Argonautica. So we're not totally unsuspecting of her, like, witchy powers, because obviously most people reading will already know of Medea. But also, you know, Cersei's her aunt. Why wouldn't she have these powers? You know, she's mm-hmm. fine. You know, she's divine as well. She probably has at least some power. So my favourite episode in the Argonautica is in book 4, with Talos, the bronze giant.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely adore this, because you have the contrast of when we first meet her to when we kind of end the book. The first meet her is this divinely sweet head. She's a beautiful young girl. She's very innocent, very almost sheltered. She still does her witchcraft and stuff like that, but she seems quite sheltered. Like, she's very sweet, very innocent. And then you get this beautiful passage of, it inspires a bit of fear, actually. So Apollonius says, her mind set upon evil, she cast a spell upon bronze Talos's eyes with her malevolent glances. Against him, her teeth ground out bitter fury, and she sent out dark phantoms in the vehemence of her wrath. And I think that is awesome.
Yeah, that's stunning.
Like, she takes down this giant with her eyes and bad thoughts. That's manifestation on a different tier. Like, I love it. I just really love how that is done. Like, this, the ability to inflict psychological harm through her eyes, like, really enhances Medea's character. And you see this thing with eyes, like, a couple more times. So Helen has the same thing. So there's, in Aeschylus's Agamemnon, it says that there's this statue of Helen, and Menelaus is sitting before it, staring at it. And it's driving him mad with longing because of the eyes in the statue.
Mm.
And he's staring at these eyes and he's just going a bit mad because he misses her. He wants her back. He's not doing anything about it at this stage. He's still, like, crying in front of a statue. I feel a bit bad for Menelaus. Like, he's not...
You shouldn't.
He's not he's not the best, but, like, he's not... he's not Agamemnon. So I think he's got that going for him. But I think he only looks a bit better because he's got that right next to him. And,
you know, yeah, well, exactly.
So, like, he's driven mad with this longing for Helen through the power of this statue's eyes. It's this effigy of Helen. It's not even Helen, which also shows her absolute beauty and power over these men, these mortal men. And obviously we see that similarly with Medea, because she's destroying Talos with her eyes and her thoughts, and that must be so scary to a lot of things. I think when people read that, Apollonius actually pauses to say, like, he, like, breaks the fourth wall and he's like, this is horrific. I hate this. He's like, this is awful. You should be scared that she can do this, which I find really funny, because I think it's the only time he does it in the book, from my recollection.
Interesting, yeah. I feel like I didn't notice that in the moment. Now I want to go back.
But it's, like, so weird. Like, he just, like, breaks the fourth wall. He's like, this is scary. Like, be afraid.
Yeah.
So, like, even, like, the writer is scared of what he's writing. He's like, protect me against this evil that this woman can inflict with her eyes, I think is, like, roughly what he says. He's like, I'm scared of this, so may the gods protect me, essentially. Because she can do this with her eyes and her mind. She doesn't need to have her potions that she's so famous for. And I just find it so interesting. So you've got this contrast of her with her divinely sweet head and all of this this girlish beauty that you have at the start. And then you have this descent into this almost depraved and terrifying woman, which is just so cool. And I think this part is, like, an ultimate embodiment of Kalon Kakon.
She's so interesting in that. And what I love so much about the Argonautica is that it's so explicit that Hera does it to her. Like, that it's so explicit that it's not natural to her. And that's what, I think that's what makes it me find it so much more, like, yeah, entertaining to be like, yeah, you're, like, a dark fucking soul in this book. But it's like, no, she wasn't doing it on purpose.
It wasn't
so
her
it's
fault.
Fine. So I can love it.
It wasn't her fault, you know?
Yeah.
It's
totally fine if I find her murder just, like, completely and utterly
I think it's justified. You know, set her free. She's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not her fault. But yeah, so just, like, to kind of sum up the whole thing, like, the theme of Kalon Kakon is not exclusive to Pandora or Helen, even, because obviously some people have made that that comparison, but can be found in a range of things. So even, like, I haven't really spoken about this, I mentioned it very briefly, the feminized Paris could be considered. Mm-hmm. Metals, especially necklaces and jewelry, specifically gold, of course, is the metal of Aphrodite, as we discussed. Circe, Medea, it's just so fascinating. And I just love it, and I hope your listeners also loved it, because it's so much fun, in my opinion.
No, it is. It's such an interesting way of looking at it, because, like, I mean, obviously I look at all these myths so often and in so many different ways, but looking at them through this, that just that one phrase that means so much, but also is so, like, subtle, you know, it's not explicit in a lot of things, but it really has this really deep meaning in Greek myth. And yeah, no, I mean, I find it fucking fascinating. It's so but cool. Then, oh God, anything in this world of Greek mythology just gets me, you know, obviously, because it's my whole life. But, like, I've been so interested in Callum Catgon. That's why I was so excited to have you on to talk about it, because it is just so fascinating. Oh my God.
It's been such a great opportunity.
Oh, I'm so thrilled. Thank you. Thank you. This is, yeah, it's so interesting. And, like, I love it, especially because it's like that little bit of actual ancient Greek that I'm slowly learning. Like, yeah,
exactly. There's some actual little by little, you know?
Yeah,
you don't have to do it all in one go. But if as long as you learn, like, some really key phrases, you can probably get by. You'll read a, like, a Loeb or something, and you'll be like, I know that phrase. It's really exciting when you see, like, a word that you recognize in ancient Greek without looking at the other side. You're like, oh my God, I know that one. It's so exciting. I will leave your listeners with one thought of one thing I have really kind of wanted to argue. Was Pandora the blueprint for all women? And would you say all women, because of this, could be read through the lens of the Callon Cacon? That's my profound thing for the day.
No, I mean, I find that so interesting, because it, you know, it opens so many questions into sourcing and you know, how broad the story of Pandora was and how deep it goes and how much we rely on Hesiod, even though he's just some random farmer from Boeotia. Right? It just, oh my God.
To be fair, like, aren't most of these men just, like, random, like,
Well, random people, like, who just have the audacity. Yeah, and, like, people who have the audacity, absolutely. And just, like, you know, what survived, what didn't.
Absolutely. Because,
like,
there's
why?
So many, like, important texts. Like, do you know what I would love to get my hands on? And I think you would too. Ovid's Medea. It's all I want in my life. I want that tragedy, because we've got Seneca, we've got Euripides. Yeah. I want Ovid's, because I know he would write it more beautifully than anyone else.
See, and, like, Ovid wrote, I think he wrote the Cadmus. He wrote something in that realm, and I would give anything for it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, there's so many Euripides. There's so many Euripides plays in the list of that we know
the list.
I'm like, fuck off, I want them all.
I have a lecturer who specializes in tragedy and comedy, mainly comedy, but she's like, what I would not give, I would give life and limb to get my hands on those. I'm like,
absolutely,
I fully empathize.
yeah all I want in the world is just the lost pieces.
I want more epic cycle, because obviously
I'm
gonna be focused. Do you know what I actually really want? I really want to decipher, not myself, but I want someone to work out linear A. That is the one thing, because I'm now looking at, for my master's thesis, reconstructing Helen of Troy. And as she would be as a Bronze Age woman, and one, it's very fucking difficult, because we don't have much written stuff, and the written stuff we do have is in Linear B, and it's mainly like, there are 6 women who work in the wool workers, or there are 5 men in the bakers. It's mainly like keeping, like, tally.
Linear B is, like, the most boring stuff, but it's so interesting that it's that language. But then it's usually like, well, we sent this much olive oil to this place, and they gave us wine. Like,
Thank you. Great, guys. Thanks.
Yeah. Super helpful. Well, why don't you tell my listeners kind of where they can find you if they want to know more, or anything you want to share?
Awesome. So I'm Alexia Burrows, Caroline Bidu. I'm currently doing my master's, and my Twitter handle is Alexia SBCL. My initials, because I'm
and it will be
so
original. In... it will be in the episode description too, yeah. So you can just click on it. Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to share? Yeah.
Yeah, if anyone has any questions or just wants to say, hey, I'm really interested, where can I find like the reading on this specific bit that you talked about? Mm. Or even if you would like to access my thing, I am at some point going to be rewriting it, reformulating it based on feedback that I got from my supervisor. But you are welcome to read it. And there are obviously some issues because I was only a mere undergraduate when I wrote it. And, you know, you're always improving. That's the main thing.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So if you want to access any of this, just drop me a DM. I'm pretty receptive, though I am a very slow replier.
More than fair.
And I'll shoot you in the way of any readings. Some books that I would really, really, really recommend are Bettany Hughes' Helen of Troy, Goddess, Princess, Whore. That's an awesome one, especially if you're interested in the more archaeological side of things. She discusses the Helen cult and the shrines and any actual evidence that we would have for her. I believe she's one of the people who made the Calancacon connection for me. Mm. Helen of Troy, From Homer to Hollywood by Laurie Maguire. That's really cool. And also if you're interested in like adaptations of Helen. So mm-hmm. You've got obviously Homer, and then you get like stuff from like the Troy film with mm-hmm. Brad Pitt and Orlando mm-hmm. Bloom and those people, which is really interesting. And then finally, the absolute key one that started my obsession, Helen of Troy, Beauty, Myth, Devastation by Ruby Blondell. Mm. That is a wonderful book.
Well, thank you so much. Honestly, it's been so exciting and wonderful.
On. It's been a real privilege to talk about this.
I'm very glad. I love all of the stuff, so I'm always thrilled when people give me great topics like this. So thank you so much.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I hope your listeners enjoyed it. And again, if anyone has any questions or queries or something they just want to say, hey, I don't think that was quite right, just drop me a message. I'm always open to criticism. And
or praise, you can praise.
I wouldn't mind praise. Like, I mean, I wouldn't be mad.
Yeah, I'm just saying, leave it open.
Yeah, absolutely,
it's wonderful.
Criticism, play, praise, or questions, just drop me a DM.
Yeah. Ugh, nerds, thank you all so much for listening. Truly such a lovely episode. So much fun to record. And I mean, you know me. I absolutely love learning this stuff. It's endless. I could learn more, and I will continue to forever. Thank you all so much for listening. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots. the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.